My name is Mohan Sriratna. I represent Sydney Water Corporation. The Honorable Minister, I wrote to you 6 months ago, and that was about how business can be encouraged to save water. And I encourage you to, and I appreciate you making the point about how cities have not addressed water management, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. But there are some things that you yourself can do. And 6 months ago, that was about how business can save water. One of them was, if business was given, not given handouts, but given depreciation, faster depreciation, they could be, there's faster ways of making improvements of water management. For example, Sydney Water's EveryRopCon business program is saving 26.5 million litres of water every day. Sydney Water, since 1991, has invested $140 million on demand management, and that goes against what you said of not the previous governments in New South Wales have not investing on water management. One of the things that you forgot to mention about is desalination and recycling only talks about water that we can use. But if we save water, we don't have to go on looking for other sources of water.
Thank you for that. I didn't catch your name, sir, but I was talking to Adrian here when you stood up, but we should have a chat afterwards about what you're doing. Sydney Water's initiatives have been very successful, and if you are the same person I think I was corresponding with a little while ago, I think you've done very well in terms of demand management in the business sector. But at the end of the day, as you know, 26 megalitres is not a very large percentage of Sydney's daily water use. So it is the fact is that we have to manage water, we have to have effective demand management of water, certainly. And there are some great examples in this book. Peter Zentel's building in Melbourne in particular, which I've inspected, and of course the RAF base, are great examples of using water more efficiently. We waste an enormous amount of water in our cities. One of the projects that I've been promoting is the reintroduction of the Botany Aquifer to Sydney's water supply, a great opportunity to harvest stormwater and use it sustainably to increase our water supply in a very material way. But so demand management's important, but it is a bit like giving blood. There is a limit to how much any business can do before it damages the business or before it reduces the amenity of a household beyond an acceptable level. The fact is that all of our big cities need to increase their water supply. So you've got to do both. You've got to use water more efficiently, but increase the water supply. And it's the failure to augment the water supply that has been the glaring omission in most of our cities in recent years.
David Boyd, Clyde Agriculture. Minister, and can I say how nice it is to be able to use that term, and congratulations. I wonder if I could in fact extend the answer you just gave a little bit to in terms of the need to use efficiently what we have, but also the need to increase supply. And I noticed that Premier Beattie, prior to this week's meeting, has made a recent announcement in the press. We released a comment this morning where he talks just about that. And whilst there's some very good things, I'm sure, that we all agree in the plan, perhaps notable by its absence is there's not a single dam in $10 billion. And I wonder whether, in fact, Premier Beattie, in fact, is not making some pretty positive suggestions, and perhaps you might be prepared to make a very early comment. I know you haven't had much time to digest it on what he has proposed.
Okay. Can you hear me right? Peter Beattie has, as I understand it, recanvassed the very well-known and long-dreamt-of idea of turning back damming and then diverting either under or over the Great Dividing Range some of the northern Queensland tropical rivers, and the Tully and the Herbert being the two ones I think that he mentioned, and diverting that into the inland of Australia. These ideas have been looked at in the past and have been found to be not feasible from economic or environmental for economic and environmental reasons. Let me get back to some fundamentals about water. Water is very heavy. 1,000 litres, which the gentleman in the back there will sell you from Sydney Water today in your bathtub at home for about $1.40 or thereabouts, weighs exactly 1 tonne. Moving water around is enormously expensive, uses a lot of energy, requires a lot of infrastructure. The bulk of the cost of any water project is distribution. You know, we have lots of great technologies for treating water, for turning seawater into fresh water and sewage into fresh water and all of those things. But you still are faced with the fact that water is very heavy, it has a low value to weight ratio, can't be compressed, and costs a lot to move it around, particularly if gravity is not doing the work or all of the work. So that is why long-distance water transport schemes tend to be almost invariably uneconomic. Now, particularly if the destination of that water are people who are not able to pay a high price for it. Now, we have commissioned, I was pilloried by the Queensland Government, curiously enough, last year, when I said that we should look open-mindedly at diverting water from the northern rivers of New South Wales, which is a mere hop, skip and a jump compared to the distances Mr. Beattie's talking about, from the northern rivers of New South Wales, such as the Tweed or the Richmond or the Clarence. Look at the feasibility of diverting that water to southeast, some of that water to southeast Queensland. Now, that is a very expensive exercise, but nonetheless, if you consider southeast Queensland, all of their new water schemes, without exception, have a marginal cost, that's to say the cost of the additional water, is in the order of $3 a cubic metre, $3 a kilolitre. So more than twice what we're paying retail for water in Sydney. So when you've got cities are able to pay top dollar for water, and so long distance transport schemes are more likely to be feasible. But as far as Beattie's proposal, it's a surmise, I think, is probably the best way of putting it, a public musing. As far as that's concerned, we have established a task force to look into Northern Australian water resources. It's chaired by Bill Heffernan. Most of our rainfall and runoff is in Northern Australia. This concept, as well as a lot of others, are going to be examined by that task force. We have to keep reviewing these ideas, but I just, emphasise, you get back to that fundamental problem with water, very low value to weight, and it costs a lot to move it around, and uses a lot of energy to move it around.
Max Thompson from Hamilton Thompson. Minister, I'd like to draw you, if I can, on broader sustainable issues for a moment. We now have a number of credible rating tools for commercial property, including ABGR and GreenStar, and yet the take-up of them is, to a certain extent, limited because the benefits are largely intangible. Can you see a time when government would introduce either incentives or penalties to hasten the adoption of such sustainable practices in business?
Well, I think all of that is feasible. The sustainability of the built environment is really a vital issue. There are a number of new building standards around Australia. I'm not sure if you're from New South Wales, but Basics is the standard here in New South Wales. Really, one of the problems we face in terms of reducing water usage and energy usage is that we have created a built environment, be it the houses we live in or the shape of the cities we've built, that require either a great deal more water than they otherwise ought to or a great deal more energy. Again, Queensland's quite a good example. If you consider the houses that people were building in Queensland 100 years ago, they were much more sustainable than the ones we're building today because they had big verandas, they were often built on stilts to allow more ventilation. So we have forgotten, due to our dependence on energy and cheap energy and available water and cheap water, we've forgotten a lot of the lessons that our forebears really probably didn't need anyone to teach them. So a more sustainable built environment is a vital part of our adaptation and response to climate change. These planning issues are very much a state government agenda, and there is nonetheless a great deal of work going on within COAG at the moment, which the Commonwealth is leading and funding or contributing to the funding of, to promote more sustainable approaches to planning. You're right to raise it. How it will be managed in the future, one can speculate about, but there's no question our built environment has to become more sustainable. And I mention again the three or four very good examples in this book.
Paul Frederick, Kemp Strang Lawyers in Sydney. Minister, you mentioned the importance that the government places on irrigated agriculture. One of the planks of the Prime Minister's $10 billion plan is that there is a need to readdress the issue of the cap on water extractions in the Murray-Darling Basin. Can you tell us whether this could, in fact, involve the compulsory acquisition of water entitlements?
There are no plans to compulsorily acquire water entitlements at all. The whole program is premised on water being recovered for the environment through efficiency measures of the kind, you know, of the investment, be it off-farm or on-farm investment, and or acquisition from willing sellers.
Fiona Wayne, Environment Business Australia. Minister, and it is indeed nice to be able to call you Minister. The last time you were here, though, you were asked a question about carbon trading and you replied as a humble parliamentary secretary. What I would like to ask you today is whether we could hope to see this national water plan merged with a national strategy on climate change that links the two together, because while there may still be some people who do not see the linkage between drought and climate change, the exacerbation, the extremes, the new extremes that we're seeing and the foreseeability of new extremes are really very serious. And in that regard, my second question is regarding emissions trading. And now that the Prime Minister has set up this task group to look into emissions trading, could we hope to see this developed and led by the Commonwealth with the support of the states, which the states have said that they will offer? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Fiona. Emissions trading is very much on the agenda. We have a task force with leading figures from government and from the private sector comprising that task force. There'll be a report in May. So we all understand how the various emissions trading schemes in place work, and indeed how some of the proposed schemes might work. It's very much on the agenda, and we will hear more about it when the task force reports. As far as the link between climate change and drought, there's always a question as to whether any particular drought is the consequence of natural climate variability or climate change. I think it's important to remember, and again I'm repeating what I said here on an earlier occasion, but I think it's important to remember that notwithstanding that all of these water availability charts or temperature increase charts have beautiful glide paths on the page, life doesn't work like that. It tends to be very bumpy. There will be step changes, and we just have to work on the assumption, even though we cannot, you know, with certainty say this particular weather event is caused by, we have to work on the assumption that the trend in southern Australia, it is essentially a hotter and drier trend. It's associated with a lot of the frontal systems that brought most of the spring and winter rain moving to some extent to the south of Australia. So the assumption has to be, we are much more likely to have less water around in the future than more. Having said that, I have no doubt we will get some very wet years in the future. But the big mistake would be to get one wet year and then say, oh, all of that anxiety about water was misplaced. You know, we have to work on the assumption that there is a trend happening here and we should adjust our water policy to it. And that, of course, is exactly what the Prime Minister's water plan is designed to do.
Minister Peter Sutherland, GHD, congratulations on the Australian Government's bold plan in relation to the Murray-Darling Basin. GHD last year undertook a review of Commission programs, and one of the things that we found was the difficulties in relation to procurement of new works and measures, particularly related to the environment, and also the difficulties in relation to integrated management of the basin assets. I understand that under the current negotiations, it's still not clear whether the state governments will cede legal ownership of the basin assets to the Australian government or the authority that will undertake the new responsibilities. It would seem a significant loss of opportunity if, in terms of a new approach to integrated management of the basin, that ownership and management of those assets was not with the national government. Could you comment on that, please?
Thank you, Peter. The proposal that we have put to the states involves the infrastructure, by which I mean dams and weirs and locks and things of that kind, regulators, remaining in the ownership of the states but being managed and maintained by the Commonwealth through its agency, which is the working title of which is Murray-Darling Basin Authority. That's the arrangement that the Murray-Darling Basin Commission has at the moment, and we haven't sought to disturb that arrangement. Your argument is that the Commonwealth should actually own the hard assets. That's a view that some states have expressed opinions on as well. No doubt it'll be discussed as the week unfolds, but the position we have put is one where the ownership remains vested in the states, but management and maintenance is with the Commonwealth, and that's essentially been the model with the MDBC in respect of those storages that it manages at the moment.
Thank you, Minister. Justin Bell from Golder Associates. My question is, we've talked primarily about, or your talk has been primarily about, quantity of water in the Murray-Darling Basin in particular. Quality of water is also very important. Salinity in the Murray-Darling Basin is a bit of a difficult beast to tame. Is the plan the government and Prime Minister has outlined taken into account what might well be the bigger challenge than necessarily that water quantity?
Thank you. That's, if I may say so, that is an excellent question, and you're making a point that I should have made in my remarks earlier. One of the, I was making the point that a lot of our critics overlook the variability of water availability, and they just think of our rivers as being a bathtub that's a sort of static volume that's too low that needs to be topped up. But the point you make is a really important one, and again, thank you for making it. The value of water is not just a function of volume. It's a function of quality. In point that you raise, salinity. If it's too saline, it obviously destroys life instead of sustaining it. There's also the question of timing. For a wetland or a floodplain to get water at the wrong time of the year can have quite a negative effect. Getting water to its destination at the right time is very important. Timing is vital. And also another factor is temperature too. That's another issue, particularly when water is released from storages. There are other factors that the hydrologists among you would be able to add to it, but it is a very important issue. Salinity management's a vital part of managing the Murray-Darling Basin, and that's a key element in all of our plans, and it's something that the Commonwealth would take charge of in the future. And indeed, as you know, the Murray-Darling Basin Commission is intimately involved with all of the salinity management schemes at present.
Thank you. It's Peter Costellos from Clean Technology Australasia. Minister, you'd be aware that Australia is not the only country in the world that is suffering a severe drought. There's 30 or 40 countries around the world that are also suffering significant drought. Many of those countries actually share a river basin with other countries, 14 in the Nile and 10 in the Danube and 10 in the Mekong. A lot of those countries, it's not just a matter of water scarcity, but also a matter of water security. where water for them is the new oil. And they don't often, many of those countries don't have the long history of innovation and R&D that we have in Australia in terms of water technologies. So my question is, do you have a vision for Australia, or a plan for the future, as you say, for Australia to take a leadership role in the acceleration of the development and deployment of water technologies, not only to address our own needs, but also for a potentially massive export market?
The Australian water technology and expertise is being exported now. And all of the consultants in the room, the water consultants in the room, the engineers in this room, know how much of their revenues is increasingly being derived from offshore. Wherever there's a water crisis, you will find a couple of Australian engineers and hydrologists, and often in the irrigation sector, Australian technology as well. That is a very big part of our future. There's no question about that. I might just say about water globally. Water scarcity globally is really at a crisis point. There are regions, I'm particularly talking about northern China and northern India and the north of the subcontinent generally, where not only are you starting to see declines in surface water availability because of reduced flows from the Himalayas, which Fiona is a very clear consequence of global warming, but you've also seen a massive, staggering extraction of groundwater. One of the many Australian hydrologists that works overseas, Evans from SKM, I don't know whether there's anyone from Sinclair Knight Mertz here, but Rick has done a lot of work in northern China with the World Bank, and his conclusion, which he's published on several occasions, is that the North China Plain, which essentially depends on groundwater for its irrigated agriculture, will have exhausted that groundwater within 10 or 15 years. Now, that is a gigantic population whose food supply is going to be sharply diminished. Similar picture in northern India. So sustainable management of water resources is a vital priority everywhere, but it underlines an important fact that we need to remind the Bill Shortons and the Peter Garretts and the Kevin Rudds of this world, that you cannot just shut down Australian agriculture in the hope that you can import food from everywhere else. I promise you, in the decades to come, there will be less food produced in the world than there is today, absent some new technological miracle. And that is because much of the increase in food production has been because of increased water availability, which has been created or established by unsustainable practices, particularly groundwater pumping.
Minister Simon Smith from the New South Wales Department of Environment and Conservation. As I think you've studied and mentioned, around the world, government bodies established to build dams and allocate water tend in the long run to be captured by those who they serve because they don't like to say no to their customers. And I wondered if you'd like to elaborate on your thoughts about Australia's new institutional design so that we could be confident that the good work to be done about setting limits, that we stick with that, and so that usage will be sustainable in the generations ahead.
Well, I think if you're talking about the new governance arrangements we proposed for the Murray-Darling Basin, that's what you're talking about? Yeah, okay. The whole premise of this plan is to first establish what the sustainable yields of the various valleys and groundwater systems in the basin are, and then ensure both at a catchment level and at a basin level that the caps are set at sustainable levels. This readjustment of caps will be based on the best science, the very best science that we have, and that in itself is the proof against a reversion to the massive over-allocation that really bedeviled water management in many parts of Australia, in particular, I'm afraid to say, in New South Wales, more so than some other places. But it is that's the basis. It will be a national, be managed by the national government in the national interest, and therefore will be much more proof against the sort of sectional interests that have so influenced
water policy in years gone by.
Can I just follow on? The National Plan mentions the establishment of a separate body as an environmental water manager. Would you mind elaborating on how you see that body working?
Well, I can very briefly, but the concept is that the environmental water that is acquired by the Commonwealth, just to recap for everybody else, the idea that the core idea in this, or one of the core ideas in this proposal, is that water will become available, be made available, by reason of investing in water efficiency measures, which obviously reduce wastage, therefore, and those water savings will be shared between irrigators and the government and the Commonwealth. That water, together with water that is acquired from willing sellers, will form an environmental reserve. Now, that will be managed for environmental purposes, but also to support irrigation security in times of desperate drought. Now, that balance, that complementarity, which may seem counterintuitive to many people, I'm sure not many people in this room, is a very key part in understanding the way Australia's rivers work. And you're already starting to see this in some of the river reach programs that are being adopted in New South Wales. Murrumbidgee Irrigation in particular has been a leader in this field. So you have a win-win where you have more secure water in the driest of dry times, but in return for that, a lot more water is made available when there is water around, so that you can deliver the environmental outcomes that you need.